welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. In this month's Something Old, Something New episode, we're breaking our previous trend of sibling duos and inviting in a writer and his editor. Alex Preston is a journalist and the author of As Kingfishers Catch Fire, This Bleeding City and In Love and War. And who is the man who's the pleasure of fine-tuning his prose? Well, that's Walter Donoghue, senior editor at Faber and Faber. And the two join me in the studio today. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
The point of this show, in fact, we've done a couple of these and we finally managed to get you two together in the studio. The genesis of it, in fact, was you, Walter, when we went out for lunch. You said, you should get me and Alex in and just talk about anything. So that's what we're going to do today. We've kind of given this show some sort of structure, the something old, something new idea. We all have something in common. We've all recently loved and lost 4321, Paul Auster's new book. Alex, this is yours, something new. You were on stage a couple of weeks ago here in London speaking to the man himself about the ins and outs of this sort of mighty saga. Tell us a little bit about why you've chosen 4321 for your something new.
I chose it partly just because I loved it, and I think that when a book speaks to you seriously, you just want to be evangelical about it. And so I've been giving it to a lot of people and I've been talking about it a lot. I also prepared a lot of questions and thoughts for my talk with Paul Auster, and it was a slightly weird experience in that he read for 35 minutes.
He did do quite a long reading.
It was quite a long reading. There was some shuffling of buttocks about three quarters of the way through the reading. And so I guess I didn't get to talk to him about all the things I wanted to talk to. So let's kind of imagine him here. He was an amazing person to interview, just this kind of lake of charisma. And
he is a laconic lake of charisma, isn't he?
Although this is a less laconic work, I guess, in that if you think about his career to date, if you think about those great early novels, you know, the books that really got me into serious literature, I think of them as the first grown-up books I read, Moon Palace, New York Trilogy, The Music of Chance, and his style is incredibly spare. It's polished to the point of almost blankness. And yet this isn't, you know, the sentence length, the complexity of the structure. And maybe we should talk a little bit about this very interesting structure that is there in the title, 4321. This is four lives of one person.
It is a great feat. I mean, it's one of those things. I went to interview Paul in New York, and I was expecting when I went into his study to see some sort of kind of monstrous graph, some sort of timeline through history of his hero, Archie Ferguson, who lives. And possibly, we don't want to spoil it, possibly he lives through all of his four lives, possibly he doesn't make it through all of them. But it's one of those things, and he does the whole thing in his head. I think he said that he kind of writes a note to himself in the margin, goes to Paris, falls down a hole, does that, basically four things for an entire chapter, and then he will simply write his way through those things. Walter, as Paul Auster's editor as well, what's that like? We talked about the thrill of the whump of that manuscript as it hits your desk. I mean, obviously, it's a PDF, but we'll try and be slightly metaphorical about it. But can you see the work in it?
Is it a PDF with him? Because I know he types everything, doesn't he?
No, but his assistant then puts it on a computer and it's then emailed. But I don't read things on devices. I actually then printed it out, and the machine kept on pouring out page after page after page until it was 1,300 pages.
Someone in the Faber offices was like, why is Walter printing out the internet? That's exactly. 4321.
But just going back to what you were saying about how he could write it without a big, huge plan, it's because so much of the book really mirrors his own life. Not that the book is autobiographical, but Paul and I are of the same generation. We both grew up in New Jersey, and across the late 40s through the 50s and into the 60s, there was very definite events that happened that makes it somehow easy, in a sense. It gives you a structure anyway, from the very conservative, quiet, repressive 50s into Kennedy arriving and suddenly everything breaking open, the death of Kennedy, the Vietnam War, so that I can see how, given that structure, he could, within each of those four lives, imagine variations of it. But what remained the same was the social kind of history.
Now, Alex, when you're preparing, when you're reading it for pleasure, when you're reading a novel as a critic as well, is a sign of a good book, sign of something possibly in 4321 that you're not seeing any of the cogs working, that you simply, it is climbing aboard a magic carpet, or are you always kind of mentally making notes in the margin?
You do get swept away, but I think one of the things I say to the students I teach is you always read as a writer, if you are a writer. And it's almost a recognition of that seamlessness that you're keeping on. And the thing that is so extraordinary about this book is that it obviously goes back in time. You have these, one of the lives in between childhood and early adolescence. You have another life, but you never feel that there's any repetition. That there was almost, as I heard about the book and before I read it, I felt kind of exhausted by it. And yet it's so readable and it's so compelling. And that's the thing that both as a writer and a reader, I just sit there marveling at how he's managed to do that.
And there's something of the masterpiece about this book, the size of it and the way that he's talked about it in interviews as well. He's not unaware of the importance of it, and it's not a full stop in the man's career, but it is certainly, it's a big work. And well, and he's talked about it with a certain amount of importance, and not reverence to his own work, but acknowledging the importance of something like this in his own sort of canon.
You know, this was one of the things we talked about during the interview, and I went back and read everything that went before interviewing him. And I picked up something in his very first book, The Invention of Solitude, which is a memoir of losing his father. And what I recognised was that he began this book almost to the day that his father had died in terms of his own life. So his father had died at 66. He was 66 when he began this. And it seemed to me very important. When we outlive our own parents, there is a feeling of kind of breaking new territory and also a feeling of something coming to an end. And so it does feel like the book of somebody who is, you know, it's like a best of album. But it's more than that. It's not only looking back over everything that's come before and trying to bring it together, but it's looking forward. It's thinking about what the next thing is. It feels weirdly like Philip Roth's Nemesis, which we now believe to be his last book, or he said it's his last book, where it's sort of saying, this is what I can do. This is how skillful I am. We had all those slightly rubbishy Roth books beforehand, and then suddenly this beautiful, I mean, in Roth's case, very slim, but masterpiece. I mean, this is a genuine masterpiece, and I think this is the book that will endure for Paul Auster.
Just finally on 4321, as we said, Alex was talking about Auster's very spare writing, a style that has been polished down to the pattern of the wood itself almost. Did you miss that a bit when you read that read this for the first time? There is a lyricism to this that maybe was a new thing for his work.
I think because the book is so different from what he had been doing. The previous two books were nonfiction books in which he was investigating his childhood. One was from the point of view of his body, the other was from the point of view of his consciousness. And it now seems that those books were kind of like training, you know, getting himself ready. Because I think, you know, now that he's kind of 70, I think as we're getting older, that us baby boomers are very aware that we are a certain kind of generation. What formed us, and actually what legacy are we leaving behind? Initially, he wanted the book to go up to now, and then he realized that would have made it so completely monumental.
That would be a magnum opus.
But I think it was because, you know, that we've left a kind of world behind us, you know, where kids, you know, can't get jobs, can't find places to live and all that. And the great kind of exuberance we had at the end of the 60s about our having consciousness of ourselves, you know, has ended up in the current state of affairs. So I think it's kind of his way of kind of looking back and saying, here we were, this kind of very kind of blessed generation, and trying to just preserve it, you know, for posterity.
Yeah, there is that sense of a bit of the end of days about it. There is something sort of fatalistic, I suppose, about it, and a denouement of maybe a career there. It's 4321. It's by Paul Auster. It's out now. It's published by Faber, obviously. Alex, thanks for talking us, leading the dance on that one. Talking of no small things, we're going to talk about Sapiens, subtitled A Brief History of Humankind. It goes arm in arm with Paul Auster's 866-page new novel. Walter, this is your choice. Yuval Noah Harari is the kind of person that kind of sets people's imaginations alight. Talk us through why you've picked this one.
Well, part of the reason why I picked it, it obviously is very stunning, but when I was in New York over Thanksgiving, every filmmaker I talked to at some point in the conversation referenced this book, or the new one, Homo Deus. This guy is somehow, like you just say, kind of stimulated people's imaginations. And although there's a lot of stuff in this book, the thing that actually struck me is what he says about stories. And I'll just read a little bit of it. the truly unique feature of our language is not its ability to transmit information about men and lions. Rather, it's the ability to transmit information about things that do not exist at all. As far as we know, only sapiens can talk about entire kinds of entities that have never been seen, touched, or smelled. Legends, myths, gods, and religions appeared for the first time with the cognitive revolution. Many animals and human species could previously say, "Careful, a lion." Thanks to the cognitive revolution, Homo sapiens acquired the ability to say, "The lion is the guardian spirit of our tribe." This ability to speak about fictions is the most unique feature of sapiens language.
So what's his tone of voice there? He's a man that kind of likes a metaphor, likes to I suppose tell a story about why we tell stories as well.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, he just grabs you from the very first moments of the book, and the thing is that's most striking about it, the first image of the book is that cave painting where there's a hand on the wall and that someone has obviously blown red ochre across it. You know, before then, the humanoids in Neanderthals, whatever the various versions were, left no traces. Homo sapiens, first one who said, "Here I am." As soon as you say "I," then you're actually, everything is different. And then I start saying "Here I am," and one of the ways of saying "Here I am" is telling a story. You know, like you're talking about Paul's book. Paul saying, "Here I was." You know, I'm part of a certain kind of generation.
And in terms of sort of the instinct to track ourselves and trace a history, there was an interesting thing. In fact, this came up in interviewing Paul Auster. I think his wife said that a story was a memory of something that's never happened, which is kind of nice kind of way of trying to hold on to something so ephemeral, the idea of a story. Is there that sort of beauty, sort of untouchable beauty in Sapiens, or is it a sort of robust telling it like it is kind of book? What's his style?
It's hard to kind of pin down because he just pulls things from every which way. And he's constantly kind of stimulating your kind of imagination. And he goes from telling, you know, there's a story about, oh, there's a lion, you know, it could be a lion god, to Facebook. These are all stories where people are being told. Behind every entity, there's a kind of story that people are told and people are actually willing to believe.
I think there's something really interesting about both of these books and this point in time and the way we're thinking about consciousness, because, of course, Homo Deus is looking forward to forms of consciousness which are not necessarily human, or to how humanity will look in the coming years. And one feels that there is this kind of fragility to our concepts of self at the moment, that as we're moving into forms of artificial intelligence, as there's scientific advances that will necessarily change the way that we think about ourselves. That I think that's one of the explanations for why these books have done so extraordinarily well. And a recognition also that state of consciousness has already changed, that we must recognize how different our consciousness is now to even 10, 15 years ago because of the internet, because of the ways these kind of shallow interactions and deep interactions we're having over the internet.
And do you feel that fiction is tackling these things as nimbly as non-fiction, I wonder? Both of you, I wonder, you know, I'm thinking of, do robots dream of electric sheep? I'm kind of thinking of whether fiction has since then kind of tried to absorb these ideas, or other prime movers, not necessarily, but accidentally at the moment, non-fiction.
Well, I think there's always been this area of which has been called speculative fiction, where you say "what if," which is what science fiction is. But and we did we published a novel a few years ago by Marcel Theroux, which was trying to imagine what is it that gives you your identity. Is your soul something that could be extracted from you and placed in another entity? You know, so that I think fiction, certain kinds of fiction, have always speculated like this about.
I mean, Don DeLillo, you know, Zero K. Yeah, I found that a fascinating book. I think it wasn't. You know, he is one of these writers who you feel has a kind of proleptic spirit. He's kind of leaping forward into the future. He seems to have an antenna that will pick up on things. And Zero K about cryogenics, about the possibility of eternal life. I found that both fascinating in terms of the way it approached the subject, but also in terms of this is what he was thinking about at this time. I think there is a kind of nostalgia, though, in novels at the moment that I think there are, you know, for everyone that's doing, you know, the kind of speculative looking forward thing that Walter's talking about. I mean, Naomi Alderman's The Power would be another one I'd talk about there. There are book more and more like, I mean, I think Paul's book is one. I mean, I don't think there is a kind of critical tone to the idea of nostalgia there, but he is trying to look back and make sense of where we are today by looking at the past.
And it's quite light-handed, that. I mean, a lot of people asked him about Trump and the parallels, and, you know, he was in the Columbia in the late 60s, political, there's all sorts of things going on, and he was quite careful not to make direct parallels, as well he might, I suppose.
Although he said a lot about protest, and I think that's one, you know, the how to successfully carry out protest, I think, is really interesting.
It is Sapiens. That was Walter's pick of something new. It's subtitled A Brief History of Humankind, Yuval Noah Harari. Alex, we were wondering whether you were going to talk about Bernard Buffet's Self-Portraits or Vita Sackville-West's Old Roses.
Well, it was something. It was something.
It's good
old
to go from something huge and broad in the history of mankind and how we think and dream to something specific. This is what we're doing here.
Yeah, well, you know, it was something new and something old, and I'd just been in Paris looking at Buffet's Self-Portraits, which I love and which I would love to talk about. But actually, I'm going to talk to you about the thing that is obsessing me at the moment, which is Old Roses. And interesting that we were just talking about nostalgia, because this is one of the things that concerns me about this current obsession, which is that I feel that there is something very backward-looking, and there is something. There was a very interesting essay by Mohsin Hamed in The Guardian the other day about the dangers of nostalgia. And as I prune my roses and cultiver mon jardin, I worry this is not something that one should be doing. One should be building barricades and throwing petrol bombs. One should not be worrying about, you know, Bourbon roses.
But with secateurs in hand, you are kind of building some. You're building your own island, presumably.
Yeah,
you're building something in your head more than as much as a garden.
So I'm writing a long piece about Sissinghurst, Vita Sackville-West's place in Kent. They're restoring the library at the moment there. It's an extraordinary collection because so many of the books were given to the Nicholsons by their various lovers. It's the 50th anniversary.
It was a busy time down there.
It was a busy
time.
It's a good thing they had a lot of doors. But it's the 50th anniversary of the decriminalisation of homosexuality. This was an extraordinary relationship, and they knew everyone. And whilst I don't think Vita is a wonderful writer, she certainly was a wonderful gardener. And I've moved down to Kent, that I'm 5 minutes from Sissinghurst. I haven't bought a house anywhere near as grand as Sissinghurst, but I have my 2 acres and I want to do something with them. And it has become an obsession. There's a rose that Vita loved called Cuisse de Naf Emu, the thighs of the moved nymph. And I've planted it everywhere in the garden, only because I love the name so much.
It's good stuff. It sounds like our mutual friend, something James Mullinger would call living the dream, Alex Preston.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's living a nightmare. I moved down there in the middle of Brexit. You know, I was surrounded by people who held profoundly different political ideas to me. I suddenly found myself taken out of cosmopolitan life and, in the way of all these things, not recognising how comforting it was to be surrounded by people where you could rely on the basic soundness of their minds. It's bizarre down there, but it's also lovely and it's wonderful, and I've been surprised by the extent to which I've embraced it.
The Cross of St George is, I think, Walter, sometimes flying at half mast down at Castle Preston.
There is one
to avoid complications.
To avoid complications, I fly the UN flag.
But what colours are the roses? Because in Sissinghurst, aren't they all white?
Well, there's the White Garden. Yeah. I mean, the Harold Nicholson describes it as a series of intimacies. it isn't one big garden. You move from small walled garden into a hedged garden, into the white rose garden where all these alba roses that are beautiful, into Vita's rose garden where she has, you know, Vita was a terrible snob and she had such a clear sense of, you know, Sissinghurst was owned by a branch of her family many years before. She was brought up at Knowle, the extraordinary country house just outside of Sevenoaks. She couldn't inherit it because of primogeniture. And these roses are for her a connection. You know, the Cuisse de Nymphemou was first identified in the 14th century. These are ancient things, and I think that it plays into that part of her mind. Now, my interest is whether it's possible to do this stuff without taking on all of that ghastly, outdated aristocratic
tosh.
So does
your garden have little private things like you just described as she has?
Well, so one of the things that, so we moved in, it's an old rectory, and the guy who had bought it from the church was a kind of racy futures trader and went fabulously bankrupt halfway through restoring the house. And so from the front, it looked rather nice, but from the back was just this, literally a heap of everything that had been kind of chucked out of the house. It was rubble, it was kind of bits of old wood, it was a mess. And so the first thing we did was kind of turn it into basically a lawn, and then slowly we're building exactly that, these little spaces where there's, you know, the children have an area where there's a vegetable kitchen garden, where there's a rose garden, and slowly we're beginning to create that idea of little areas, each of which has its own distinct identity.
I love that we've kind of got into the realm of Vita Sackville-West's garden and roses. Gertrude Jekyll, Dixter, all these kind of... I thought we might not cover these kind of things on the Culture Show. I'm liking this. I'm also just liking listening to you two talking together. That's what this is supposed to be about. We're going to leave Vita and Castle Preston for one moment, because we're going to turn to you, Walter, finally. Now, this is a fantastic... I've been poring through this. Amazing choice. Ira Gershwin's notes on his lyrics. Mm. Tell us why you picked this, other than the obvious reason that it is a fascinating look at how someone works and writes and uses rhythm and melody.
Well, because I saw the production of An American Paris. The musical is based on the American movie. It was done, I think, in the 50s with Gene Kelly, and that when they made the movie, they just filled it full of the Gershwin brothers' songs, so that none of the songs were written. I don't think any of them songs were written originally for the musical, but then, because I think by that point George Gershwin had died. I had a copy of the Ira Gershwin's book about having wrote the lyrics. So after I saw the musical, which is incredibly entertaining, and because of the music, it's just kind of just emotionally overwhelming. So I went back to see what he had to say about the songs that are in it. Also because I think, and we were going to talk about stories, but I thought it would be good to sometimes talk about words. Like,
so we've got, I got rhythm here. And he talks about why that's a more powerful way of saying it than I've got or I have got rhythm. I guess it's direct, it's all the rest of it. But the way he writes about his own writing is quite amazing.
Yeah, he says that it's not I've got rhythm, it's just I got. In other words, so it's very, the music is, I can't sing, and so I won't try to do that. It is it's the opening song in this production, and it just boom, 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 it just grabs you. And what he's interesting is, in terms of how you use words, he says got is actually the past tense of get, but that's not how he used the word got. He got as if it was actually have. So like he says, if you say I've got a toothache, it's not you had a toothache in the past, it's I have it right now. So using got, I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man, you can ask for anything more. It's very, very kind of direct.
I got Daisy. I got my man, who could ask for anything more? Old man trouble.
There is something amazing, there's something quite intimate about that. There is the idea, also perfected by Ira Gershwin, of knowing how to do it perfectly so you can do it wrong with style, as presumably how he uses language, like all good writers, I suppose. When you look at this, do you kind of feel like it's something that you can simply read, the writing about his lyrics? Is it a nourishing thing to read, even if you don't know the tunes?
Yeah, because the words, the lyrics are right in front of you, so you can refer back to it. And he says, like in one of the songs, He uses never, never, no, no. He keeps on repeating these words, always, always. And then he says that in retrospect, he found a better way of doing it. But in fact, this repetition, which is so odd, always, always, never, never, no, no, gives a kind of flow to it, you know. That's what was interesting to me. Like when that song, it's wonderful, you know, he said he gets really angry when, you know, people sing it as it's wonderful, it's marvelous. And the whole reason why he wrote the song, the lyrics that way, because he liked to play with the fact that it's has an S, the next word, and just take the S off the it's and put it in front of wonderful. And it just has a beautiful kind of sound.
Do you get the impression from reading it that these are things that he conceives in advance, or that this is the explanation of something that's quite instinctive?
Well, I think, you know, it probably helped that all these things were written with his brother. And I think probably at a certain point, you know, and there were probably certain situations where George Gershwin wrote the tune and then gave it to him and said, can you fit some words in? But I think a lot of it, like with the Coen brothers, you know, that they work together, and there's a kind of way in which when there's two of you, I think it does stimulate you in kind of ways that you weren't kind of expecting. So, and I think they did it for years and years.
Yeah, there's something you're talking about riffing off his brother. He says filling in the 73 syllables of the refrain wasn't as simple as it sounds. I was going to do that before I put the cat out. It's no small job. And there is that thing, I suppose, yeah, of the back and forth, I suppose. And maybe if we try to bring it full circle, the idea of a novelist and an editor pushing and pulling a little bit to polish the finished article. Finally, what's your experience of that? The two of you are friends, but are a writer and an editor. What back and forth is there between? How does that process work?
Well, it's always my favourite part of a book is both in terms of during the writing. Walter and I have tea together at the LRB bookshop, and Walter always asks these just brilliantly insightful but open questions that. I always leave those meetings absolutely buzzing with ideas, desperate to get back to work. But also, you know, I don't know how many editors like Walter there are around who give the work the kind of attention he does. And it's, you know, a manuscript that has been edited by Walter is a thing of beauty. So it is. It's an amazing thing to have an editor like this.
We talked about that, the thrill of the manuscript landing on the desk. Walter, I suppose that's the thing. Do you always read with a pen in your hand? Is it possible to put it down?
No, I think the first time I read whatever the manuscript is, I put the pen aside. So I just want to get a sense of what it is. As soon as you start making little notes and all that, you're actually interrupting the flow of how the work is working. You have to allow the book to tell you what it's doing. You have to give yourself to it. As soon as you put a pen in your hand, you're actually removing yourself from it. So I usually read it first without, you know, as much as I can in one sitting, and then I go back and then go through it sentence by sentence.
And it wraps up nicely with that comment you made about Ira Gershwin's writing about his writing, Alex, is whether it is the explanation of something that is simply instinct, or whether it is all plotted out. Read maybe one of Alex Preston's novels, maybe read Paul Auster's novel, and see if you can do the reading between the gaps. Let's just finally wrap up what you gentlemen chose. We started off with 4321, it's new from Paul Auster, and then Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, Yuval Noah Harari. And we talked about Ira Gershwin writing about his wonderful writing, filling in those 73 syllables is no small thing, and Vita Sackville West's Old Roses. Sounds like a song, doesn't it? My thanks to Walter Donahue and Alex Preston. That was Something Old, Something New. That was the whole point we did this programme, to have you two in the room. So thank you very much for joining us. I've been Robert Bound. This show was produced, of course, by Holly Fisher. For the time being, thanks for tuning in.